Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
The moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-o! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Technology Truths, brought to you by GEICO.
Technology Truths.
Truth. Teenagers can communicate entirely in emojis.
How was the birthday party? Pizza slice, kitten, soccer ball, pineapple?
Truth. It's so easy to switch and save on car insurance at GEICO.com.
What are you talking about? Paperclip, shoulder shrug, high five, wizard hat? What?
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
I'm Laurel K. Hamilton, creator of the Anita Blake Vampire Hunter series and Meredith Gentry, a fairy princess and private detective. You're listening to This Week in Geek with Mike the Birdman Dodd, Steve Snowball Sailor on 90.1 FM, the new heat, Niagara's hottest mix.
The following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
Thinking impaired.
And we did all that without computers.
They don't let us out much.
Have an intro?
Not really. This is just us ad-libbing.
Are you ready for a sexy party?
Son of Jor-El, kneel before God.
Or me, whichever.
If you've seen Godzilla vs. Mothra 37 times, I think I've got a show for you.
You're listening to This Week in Geek with Mike the Birdman Dodd and Steve Snowball Sailor here on 90.1 FM, The New Geek.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another interview with This Week in Geek. I am, of course, Steve Snowball Sailor, and today I'm joined with...
Mike the Birdman Dodd.
And Ashley Kivel, every geek's favorite accessory.
And, of course, and today, if you're out there and you're a geek and you're a fan of vampires and the hunters who kill them, when we mention the name Anita Blake, what name comes to mind? If you say Laurel K. Hamilton, you gain +5 in necromancy, because today we have the honor of Miss Hamilton on the line. Hello, Miss Hamilton, how are you?
I am doing very well. How are you guys?
We're doing awesome.
Great. Excellent.
So, now the first question we want to ask, obviously, is we usually start off with, this is going to be a very James Lipton Inside the Actor Studio type of interview today.
Again with the Actor Studio
reference.
Oh,
I love that show. James Lipton's awesome.
We love that show. We love that show too.
See, there you go. All right. So, now, where did you grow up?
I was raised in Sims, Indiana, which is a town so small in northern Indiana that the one of the major papers called it a hamlet because they couldn't find it on a map.
Really?
I know how you feel.
We all do. We all come from small towns.
Under 100 people. Small.
Not that small.
300 for me, but that's very, very, very small.
So I guess with that, a town that small, that's kind of where, I guess, your imagination started to grow, I assume?
Well, yeah. It's one of those things. If I had lived in an environment where I had more to do, would I be less imaginative and less successful now? Maybe.
Oh, okay.
But I've always told myself stories.
Oh, okay. So is that when did you really start to get the creative writing bug?
I was 12 and a half. Why do I know I was 12 and a half? Because for years, all my characters were exactly my age.
Oh.
And it's actually my early efforts. I started trying to write at 12 and a half and finished my first story at 14.
And what was the name of this story?
It had no title. It was a bloodbath.
Oh, really? So maximum carnage.
Even at 12 and a half, you had quite the sick imagination.
No. At 12 and a half, I was trying to write Louisa May Alcott Little Women stories. And then somewhere between 12 and a half and 14, I found Robert E. Howard's short story collection called Pigeons from Hell. And that changed. Not only did I think, I want to be a writer, but this is what I want to write. I'd never read horror or dark fantasy until that moment. And it was a revelation.
So did you also like Stephen King, The Birds? Because I know those were birds from hell as well. Is that where you got some of your inspiration?
Stephen King, I guess the most influential book for me from him would be Salem's Lot.
Really?
It was vampires set in modern day. One of the scenes that I like the best is when you have some of the new vampires that hidden under a trailer. like that little crawl space under a trailer. It was one of the most unromantic vampire moments in vampire literature at that time, and it made them very, very real. I think that I was like in junior high when I read this book, so I think it had a real influence on me.
Okay, so now was that what kind of led you to coming up with the whole, obviously, Anita Blake vampire hunter kind of character? Like, did you start off with kind of thinking of a character to write about a character, something like that? Or was it a process that you went through to kind of build up to that kind of a character?
Actually, Anita comes from reading hard-boiled detective fiction just after college. And the guys, the male detectives, they got to cuss, they got to kill people without remorse, and they got to have casual sex. The female detectives at that time, they didn't get to cuss, hardly at all. If they killed somebody, they had to feel really, really bad about it. And sex was either not mentioned at all or was very off stage. I thought this was unfair. I wanted a character that could keep up with the guys. But I thought straight mystery wasn't my cup of tea. I've always loved fantasy, monster movies. So I wanted a world where I could play with those too. The combination of hardboiled detective, female character, and my love of myth, fantasy, and monsters, that's where Anita comes from.
So when you created the world of Anita Blake, basically, like, did you draw inspiration from other fantasy horror settings, such as maybe Shadowrun, for example, which is a world where elves and trolls exist and there's magic in the world, or did you have a more real world basis for the world?
Bear in mind that I created Anita at the end of the 80s, 1980.
Wow.
Like late 1980s. So I predate almost all of this.
You are the landmark.
I am the landmark. The first short story that I wrote did not sell because everybody said mixed genre doesn't sell. We don't know what to do with it. It took years for the first book to sell because, again, people said mixed genre didn't sell. Vampires were dead, pun intended.
And now they are kicking themselves.
I've had a lot of the editors that rejected me say to me in person, oh, I wish I'd had a chance at your book. And they're almost always the editors that had the most scathing rejection slips or called you on the phone and were scathing on the phone. And so they're always the ones that come back later and say, I wish I'd had a chance. And then you get to be petty or not. I usually do give in to this impulse and say, well, actually, you did. And I can quote. And then I quote them how they rejected me. Because, you know, every once in a while it's that petty moment that does bring pleasure.
What exactly was it like when you were rejected the first time? Because some of us here, Steve, for example, is a writer and he has yet to face his first rejection in being published. What is that like?
Thanks, Mike.
No offense,
man. What's that like? I got my first rejection slip when I was like 17. I was already trying to sell. I took Ray Bradbury's advice of pick a small room of your house and paper it with rejection slips. When you have it completely wallpapered, then you will have sold.
Oh.
Rejection is just part of how it is to be a writer. That is just the nature of the game. It's better than being an actor because at least you're not being rejected in person. But being rejected is... I'm sorry. Rejections, as a general rule, never bothered me that much because I expected to be rejected. I went in going, okay, I'm not perfect at my craft yet, so of course I'm going to get rejected. I think it would have actually messed with me more if I'd gotten accepted right away. I think that would have thrown me more.
Okay. So what was the first story that you were able to actually get published, and what was the process that you went through to get that published?
Well, do you mean the first one that was purchased or the first one that hit publication?
The first one that was purchased.
First one that was purchased was Stealing Souls, and it was bought by Marion Zimmer Bradley for her short story anthology, which she called like it was a 5.5 or 6.5 of her Sword and Sorcery series. It's not one of her Sword and Sorcery books. But it's, oh my God, the name of the anthology has just escaped me. It's fled into the field with all the other ideas that come and go.
So that's where they go. I've always wondered where it went.
There is a field somewhere where all those ideas that are on the tip of your tongue flee, and they're cavorting out there in the woods.
It's somewhere in Utah.
Yeah, and it's a graveyard,
all
too.
All the missing socks that you put in the dryer.
Yes.
Yes, they're all, yes, and they're wearing the little socks on their mitten, on their little hands like mittens, and they're off consorting with each other.
I think we're on to something here.
This better be in the next book.
It was called Stealing Souls, and it was, originally I sent it in for Sword and Sorcery, but she had so many good stories that she did a second anthology that year, and that was my first sale. It was a very straightforward Sword and Sorcery. And having reread the story recently, because we did a short story anthology this last year, called Strange Candy, I went back and reread my short stories. Oh my God, you can tell I was a gamer. Reading this story, you can almost hear the dice in the background, man.
Nice.
I was a gamer. And I was a gamer when I was doing this currently, but I didn't realize how much it showed on the page till I went back and reread the story, and then I went, oh gosh. I certainly had my own world and my own rules, but it very much showed
actually
what my hobby was.
Actually, that's one thing I've actually always wanted to ask you. I've been a fan of your work for about 2 or 3 years now. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been approached to create the Anita Blake role-playing game?
We've had some tentative approaches, nothing serious, nothing where the person had all their ducks in a row, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know how it would be run, but we have been approached, but nothing serious.
Yeah, because once upon a time when I, just before I entered college, I actually wrote a set of rules for the Anita Blake role-playing game in my own mind for for Wizards of the Coast's D20 Modern. I'd be happy to send you a copy if I can find it.
I don't know if my agent will let me see it.
Damn.
You can send it to my agent.
I could try.
Yes, you could. Because everything like that for gaming, for ideas and stuff, everything goes through my agent now due to, unfortunately, some people with no sense of humor at all have made that necessary.
Hmm. Have you ever written any D&D type or role-playing kind of games or anything like that?
Well, my first book, Nightseer, and also the world where many of my first short stories are set, was actually originally, I've been making notes on it, but I finally ran it as a campaign originally. And it was fun, but the characters, the players wouldn't do what I wanted them to do, because of course they had minds of their own. And I got very frustrated with them, and finally one of them said, well fine, if you don't like us playing in your world, why don't you take it away and write it like a novel, because that's obviously what you want to do. Well, so I did. And I got it published.
Wow.
And, you know, so originally Nightseer was a world where I set people in and I had a campaign going.
Do you still play D&D in the role-playing games now, or?
No. I don't have a lot of time for hobbies anymore. That's one of the sad things. You start off by love of gaming or love of reading. And then as you get more successful in the field, you have less and less time to do stuff that isn't actually related to the job. Hmm. Kind of the ironic side of success in this field.
So you've obviously taken something that was originally a hobby and turned it into a very busy career. And I actually wanted to jump right into the Anita Blake series and ask you a couple questions. One of them came from a friend of mine who has been reading your entire series. I mean, this girl was very excited when we told her that we were going to talk to you today, and she really was interested to know where you learned all your information on the Louisiana voodoo and, like, South African culture and myth lore. Where did that come from?
Well, actually, you always start off with books and short stories. I read an article in a magazine I don't even remember now. Like I said, it was 1980-something. That had a small article on voodoo, on Vauden, and I had really known very little about it at that point. And I read that, and then that got me thinking about, originally Anita was supposed to be just a zombie, raising the dead as zombies. She wasn't actually originally connected with vampires at all in my mind. And I got some books on actual voodoo and Vauden as a religion and a faith. In fact, I'm looking at my bookshelf now. voodoo in Haiti, and voodoo and hoodoo. I've got, you know, I had the Serpent in the Rainbow. It reads very well. I'm not sure it's really good as a research tool. But I went out and actually got books on voodoo. And then after you do your book research, then you find people that actually practice something as their faith and get them to talk to you. But you got to do your research first, because otherwise you sound like an idiot. If I hadn't done my research, I would have thought that the shambling movie zombie and what I do in my own book was real. And there is nothing, nothing in voodoo like the shambling movie zombie. That is not true. If this is your path of faith, you don't believe that you're ever going to be able to raise the dead as a zombie. That is just not real.
Oh.
In fact, I was worried that people would be upset because it is their path of faith. And I had a gentleman who practiced voodoo, and he came up to me after I think the third book was out, had a lot of zombies on it. And I really thought he was going to take me to task. But he said that it was the best written voodoo he'd seen in fiction, which I was very pleased to hear. And I said, but my movie zombies, that's not real. And he says, no, but they're so fun.
Well, they are fun.
Well, they are. But what I've learned is if you do your real research in real life, people will let you take liberties for fiction. But if the rest of it is very accurate, they're happy. So I did books and then talked to people that practiced it as their faith. That's where I started. I started with what was real and then took that jumping off point to fiction.
Okay. Well, obviously a lot of your stories deal with the supernatural kind of element, as it were. So you said you do a lot of research and all that. Were you kind of interested in the supernatural element before you really started writing, or was this kind of something you developed as you were doing research for your work?
I have loved things that go bump in the night as long as I can remember. By the time I was 5, I was begging my grandmother to let me stay up and watch like the original Boris Karloff Frankenstein by myself. And she says, well, I won't stay up with you. You have to stay up by yourself. I said, fine.
You watch Boris Karloff's Frankenstein by yourself?
At 5. I got to the point where Igor is torturing him with the torch. And then my nerve failed. And I had to turn off and run from my bed. And, of course, jump very wide so that the monster in the bed didn't get me.
Wow.
Nice.
But I have, as far back as I can remember, I have been attracted to things that go bump in the night. It's just always been a part of me. And I used to blame it on early tragedies, like my mother's death. But I remember prior to her passing away that I loved horror movies even then. And when I got up old enough to read, I read ghost stories and myth and folklore. I've always loved this stuff. And the Creature Feature Movie Hour was my friend as a child.
Wow.
Now, just out of curiosity, Laurel, have you ever had any supernatural experiences in your personal life?
I don't know if I want to answer that.
Oh, I touched the nerve.
No, but no matter what I say, somebody will listen to this, and then they'll get on the internet. The internet is a wonderful tool for good or for evil. And then whatever I say will get blown out of proportion. Even having refused to answer the question will get me in trouble. Because then they'll speculate.
We still love you.
Yes. We do. Yes.
Let's just put it this way. I believe in a lot of things that go bump in the night, but not as I write them.
Okay. Yeah, because I've always wondered if you've ever had an experience with the supernatural, just because some of your writing just kind of suggests to me that maybe like there's maybe something a little deeper into it. So that's kind of why I asked, because we here at Twig, we've actually talked with a professional ghost in investigator before. We've actually had our studios checked for things that go bump in the night. And well, the results are inconclusive.
Stranger than fiction.
Exactly.
Well, I find that I think that most dwellings could do with a good practitioner or energy worker going through and just helping move things along. You know, whatever you think ghosts are, whether you believe that they are part of the souls of the once living, whether you believe that they are strong emotions that have become embedded into the physicality of a building like a tape recorder, whatever you believe they are, there is too much evidence of them existing for anybody saying to want to say they don't exist. The very prevalence of them in cultures across the world says there's something there. I won't argue what it is, but to say that there's nothing there, actually, you know, Vegas wouldn't take those odds.
Okay.
Answer. I like that.
Yeah. So now with obviously when you mentioned the fact that supernatural things happen, but not necessarily as you write them, has there anything that really that's been a part that's more personal or more part of your life that influences your stories, or is there something that's always embedded into your story that's specifically you?
I'm not entirely sure how to answer that question. A lot of me goes into Anita's voice because it's first-person narrative and it's easier to write something closer to how you think and talk. But our lives were much more alike at the beginning of the series, and then our lives have diverged a great deal, coming back together more as recently. We're both very, very stubborn, very determined. And Anita's very much her own person now. She's made choices in her life. I mean, I live in suburbia. I have, you know, four dogs and a elementary age child, and I'm happily married. And these are all things that I'm not sure she's going to have. I'd like her to get a dog eventually, you know, a pet. I love animals, so I keep trying to give her animals. But even the fish, you know, she went away on a trip, and her fish even died. They got ick while she was gone. So her life just isn't conducive to having other things to take care of other than the people in her life. I don't know. I guess the biggest theme for me that is part of my personality and comes up in my writing is fairness. I want people, and I really want people to be fair. I want people to let everybody believe what they believe, love who they love in the way that works for them as long as everybody's consenting adults, and not to judge everybody. That probably is one of the biggest themes for me in my life and in my writing. One of my biggest turnoffs is people who are very judgmental of anybody that's different from them. Because by that, they don't give you a chance. They just make one snap decision about something in your life. And I find that very limiting.
Now, you, in the beginning, when you wrote Anita, she was very judgmental in the beginning, and eventually you did work that into your works, that she was accepting of the vampires and started to live with them and even love them and be in relationships with them. What made you put her in that type of situation?
Well, I didn't plan on her ever dating or being romantically involved with the vampires. In fact, at the beginning of the series, John will testify to this, I said loud and long that I would never do that. That was such a cliche, the romantic vampire. And so I fought that a long time. But as far as her change of attitude, the world being at the beginning of the series very black and white, and as it progresses being more gray, that is because I actually interviewed real policemen and real combat veterans, because that was the closest to what Anita does is a vampire executioner. She has to kill people that look like people on a regular basis. And I thought, I need to talk to people that do the closest I can come to what she does. People were very generous in talking to me. And I watched some people, I've now had friends that have been 10-year veterans, and I've watched them go from the bright-eyed rookie who was going to save the world and it could all be fixed to, you know, a decade later, you kind of know, well, it can't all be fixed. And you get kind of worn down by the process of it. And people talking to me about the price they had paid for doing much less violence, actually, than Anita. Anita probably has the highest kill count in literature outside of a war novel. But they paid a great deal of price personally for this. And so Anita's growth, if I had not interviewed people and talked to them about their real police experiences and real, you know, military experiences, Anita would not be the character she is. She would not have paid the price because I wouldn't have known about the price. So a lot of her changing attitude actually reflects what happens to people I've known who have gone from bright-eyed rookie to somewhere between 6 and 10 years. You just begin to be happy to be alive and get to go home to your family at the end of the day. You try to catch the bad guys, but you no longer believe that there's a way to make it all right. You just have to begin to make what right you can.
Okay. So now, with going back to that sec for as far as the romance in Anita Blake, obviously, kind of later on in the series, the content of the I'm trying to say this as carefully as possible. The content of it basically it starts to get more into the adult and mature relationships that Anita has. What made you kind of really start to kind of go into that kind of more adult themes?
Well, it took us 6 books to cross the Great Divide and have sex on paper, actual intercourse on paper. 6 books in. And I had written crime scenes where you could count the body parts. I had done graphic violence for 5 books. And then I came to a scene where it was a making love between 2 consenting adults who had who cared about each other, and I wanted to do the 1940s pan to the sky. My camera had not flinched in 5 books on violence, but sex. I wanted to flinch. I wanted to not see it on camera. And I thought, what does that say about me as a person? That I'm okay with violence and carnage, but let there be a tender moment between 2 adults, and I don't want to see it. Well, one, it makes me very American.
Mm-hmm. That is true.
That is true. I don't know why culturally we're like this, but, you know, we are. And because it made me uncomfortable, I made sure that I couldn't flinch. I made sure that I would do the scene, not only do it right, but I would do it well. Because I don't want to do it if I'm not going to do a good job of it. Now, why the sexual... But also, I was tired in the horror genre of seeing that every time you have sex in the horror genre, you're punished. What's with that? I mean, only the virginal survive? Well, then the species would die out, wouldn't we? So I thought if we're going to have sex, one, it will be good sex. It will be tender. And you don't get punished for the sex itself. The relationship may not work out, but the sex itself should not be a punishing thing. I think that that is a bad message to put out there. So... that once having made that decision, those decisions, I was kind of caught in my own process. And I did not intend us to have more men than you can count on one hand in the relationship. This was totally unplanned for me. And a lot of it happened because I would try to fix Anita's relationship. I brought Richard on to marry her. He's our Boy Scout. He's our good guy that's supposed to write in and take care of it. And the more I pushed her at him, the more they fought. So I finally realized that if I would just stop pushing, that I might not make the relationship work less well. Anita's very stubborn, very cantankerous. And if you push her one way, she'll go the other, like a lot of our friends when you give them dating advice. The sexual content is necessary to the book. It's not gratuitous. And it shows character and intimacy and plot better than I can do with anything else. Nothing shows how a couple interacts as succinctly and is movingly as how they are alone in the bedroom. That is really the core of your relationship. And one of the things by having Anita not have one specific sweetie but have more than one person she's in a relationship with, I'm hoping to dispel this myth, this very destructive myth, that there is only one soulmate out there for you. And so if you're in a relationship and it's not working, then it must be that person's fault. So we'll leave him or her, and we'll go on to the next person. No, actually, being in a relationship is hard work. By showing you have the same woman in relationships with different men, but the relationship is different because the men are different, but it's not different because the woman's different, but she has to react differently to them, I'm hoping to show that Anita might be able to be happy with several of these men. It wouldn't be perfect, but perfection is not what we're going for. We're going for happiness. Happiness isn't about perfection. Happiness is about how much compromise you're willing to do.
Very sound advice. I'm sorry, I like that.
Yeah.
I'll get off my little soapbox now.
That's okay. It's a great soapbox.
That was extremely well said.
Really great. And I think for such a little character, very tiny, petite girl with a very, very big mind and very big morals, I think it would not be expected to keep her with one guy. I think it would take a lot of guys to satisfy such a big character like that. And actually, I want to ask you more about, I have to pronounce this right or my friend will get very mad at me, the ardour, the whole sexual, you know, thirst and the need for this sex to go on before it overcomes you, kind of like a beast. What was that about? Where did you get the inspiration for that?
Well, the other came in part because Anita had all these uber powers, but as some people would point out, she wasn't paying a big enough price. She seemed to gain all these powers, and there wasn't a large downside. So I thought, well, that's a fair thing. We need a downside. So I thought, what would bother Anita most? Well, what would bother me most? Huh. Well, short of the thing that would bother her most probably would be going and tearing some throats out and truly having a blood hunger. But the ardour was a compromise short of that. And also, the ardour was supposed to be something that came in. It wasn't supposed to be this overwhelming thing. I didn't plan on it being as big a deal as it was. But I finally realized if you bring in a major metaphysical event, you can't just wave your magic writing pencil over it and fix it instantly. We're still struggling with the outcome of trying to get the ardour under control. If we had not had the ardour, she would not be with Nathaniel. She would not be with Micah. I mean, the series would be completely different if the ardour had never risen. Just as I had planned to kill Jean-Claude off at the end of book 3 because he was trying to take over my series and I couldn't do it, and it would be a totally different series again. My subconscious tends to know more than I do about where I need to go, and this was what was handed up to me one day as I was trying to come up with a downside to her power growth. And I also want to do something I'd never seen done before, something unique. And so there you go.
The internet can be your window to the world, or an open door that lets cyber criminals in. Online theft, webcam spying, and identity fraud are all on the rise. But you can stay safe with Kaspersky Lab, the world's most awarded internet security. Kaspersky protects your money, privacy, identity, and data with technology perfected over 20 years. So keep exploring. Kaspersky Lab will keep you safe online. Learn more at Kaspersky.com.
You shouldn't go to Barnes & Noble and buy 10,000 books just so you can build a book fortress and yell out, "I am your book leader." You shouldn't buy 147 copies of War and Peace, stuff them inside turkeys, and serve them at Thanksgiving as turbookins. And you definitely shouldn't buy up all the copies of Dork Diaries, causing the neighborhood kids to stage a protest in your front yard. But you could, because at the Barnes & Noble Book Haul, you can get over 1,000 titles for 50% off. Stock up at your local Barnes & Noble. Turbookins are fictitious and should not be cooked at home.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, moving on now, as we're kind of going more into that kind of, I guess, the nitty gritty of actually writing, for those who are out there and that are interested in writing a book or whichever, and knowing your process of what you go through, like, what is, would you, when you come up with an idea for an actual novel or short story or any story for that matter, do you just come up with a general idea and then outline from there? Or do you just kind of, are you more of an organic writer where you kind of just write from the hip and then just go and just see where the story takes you?
Well, I am a very organic writer. With a short story, you can come up with an idea, sit down in an afternoon and do a short story, which I've done in the past. With a book, it's harder. I will come up with an idea and usually do, like, I know the major events that have to happen, especially with a mystery. You have to know what your clues are. You have to know who or what done it. You have to know motive. But beyond that, I will often have choice A, B, and C for the characters at certain pivotal points. And once they've chosen A, B, or C, that changes the rest of the book. Because I let my characters have their heads, if they come up with a better idea, I go with it. I've thrown out the entire last half of a book before because Anita was just better than the bad guy, and she got away when she wasn't supposed to. If I outline in detail, that wouldn't happen, but I think that it also would stifle my characters, and I write so I can find out what happens next. So if I knew exactly what was happening, I think I'd be bored. So I plot the major events for the mystery. I plot some of the major relationship arc, and beyond that, the characters come up with a lot of stuff and surprise me on their own, which is one of the things that keeps me writing and reading.
Okay. Now, when you actually are in the process of actually writing, What are the things that you need to do in order to be able to kind of get yourself into that kind of creative mode? Like, do you write alone? Do you write with a bunch of people? Like, do you handwrite? Do you type? Like, what is the process that you go through to write?
I have actually never written a book that wasn't on a computer. And if I'm stuck, I'll write longhand, and I do notes longhand, and sticky note queen. I outline a book and do sticky notes, and I will come up with an idea, and I will write on a sticky note and put it over the computer so I can look up and see it. I'm very visually oriented. On the books, I write by myself. It's a very lonely process in many ways. You are just up in a room by yourself with your imaginary friends. And though I love my imaginary friends, it's really just me up here, contrary to popular internet rumor. For the comic books, First Death, which is actually a sequel to Guilty Pleasures, the first Anita book. Prequel. Yes, thank you, John. I wrote it with my husband and partner, Jonathan, and I had never written with a partner before. I had never tried it. I thought I didn't share well enough to, but it was the most fun thing. I could type for a little bit, and then I'd go, you type for a little bit, and I got to pace and brainstorm. And it was really fun to not have the entire weight of the project just on my shoulders, but to be able to share. And also, the comics are just really dialogue for the most part. And since I'm used to writing 600 to 1,000 page novels where I have to describe every piece of clothing and every room and all myself, with the script for the comic, you know the artist is going to come in and describe all this to you. It's just mostly dialogue. That was just like incredibly freeing to just go, I just have to tell what they say. The artist will draw everything else. That's so cool. And Jonathan has a better visualization of comic than I do. I'm still learning how to visualize it in my head, the difference between writing a novel and writing a script is very different. And I'm told that not everybody can make the transition, and not everybody can appreciate what the visual medium, whether it be comic or a movie camera, can do for your words. I seem to have grasped what a comic can do and how that can marry with the script. But with the novels, it's an idea and me alone in the room trying to create something out of nothing. And there are days when it's glorious and the muse is sitting on your shoulder and it comes in this amazing rush and you just get this writer's high, like a runner's high. And then there are days when you sit there and think you're killing trees to no purpose and you're taking up space that could be better served for a plot that would work. And there's always this moment of despair in a book. Every writer I know gets a moment of despair. Some get it early in the book, some in the middle, some towards the end, where you're just sure that the book will never work. Now, if you push past this wall, again, it's like running a marathon. If you push past the wall, then you get a surge of energy and you realize there's nothing wrong with what you were writing other than you just reached that moment of despair. But a lot of beginning writers, I find they hit that wall and they think there's something wrong with the book. There isn't. There's something wrong with the editing part of your head. The editing part of the writer has to stay out of the way for the first draft, because you'll kill your first draft. You'll kill the baby before it's even born, because you get overly critical of yourself. And I find that I cannot work and edit at the same time. I have to do first draft and then do any editing either the next day if I need to do some cleanup, or especially early in my career, I did the first draft of the book before I did any heavy editing. Because to slow down to edit, just I couldn't finish. Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons it took me several years to finish a short story when I was younger, because I would try to edit as I went. I can't do that. Some writers can, I cannot.
Oh, I have actually sort of a personal question to ask you. When you're writing your books and you write something that's very, maybe you didn't plan to kill off a character, but then partway through you plan to kill off this character because it needs to be done or whatever like that, you find you get so deep into your writing and so deep into your world that you find yourself crying or getting very angry over moments, and you actually have to stop because you are feeling the same emotions that these characters are feeling.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I didn't realize I did this, but I'm sort of like a method actor. I know there's different schools of method acting, but by that I mean a method actor will get so into the character that they actually warn people they're doing scenes with that if I'm trying to kill you, I really try to kill you. I don't get quite that caught up, but if somebody dies on stage, I am still traumatized by some people that have died in the series. I usually don't know it's coming. Usually if somebody's going to die just minutes before it happens, that's when, as I'm writing it, that's when I know. I don't usually plan anybody's demise. I don't like that. I like to keep everybody alive if possible, because that's one of the things about fiction as opposed to real life. In fiction, you can pretty much keep everybody alive. In real life, not so easy. So, yeah, I cry with my characters, and I find that if Anita spent one of the books angry and very anxious, and I was angry and anxious, and for days I couldn't figure out why. And finally, finally the light bulb came on, and I said to Jonathan, I have to get out of this mindset. I have to distance myself from the book and still be able to write it because it was affecting my mood. And that is still one of the most difficult things with writing, especially Anita. Mary too, but really Anita. If I've had an emotionally trying day with her, I will end up having that color my mood. And since what Anita mostly does is, serial killer cases, she's having major fights with people she's in love with, She's not always in a happy mindset. And, you know, I'm having to write these very intense emotional scenes and then having to deal with, you know, the munchkin knocking on the door. And you have to switch gears. You have to be able to shut it off. I'm not really good at that. I really do carry the book around in my head a lot, and a lot more than I thought I did. So I'm still working on how to balance that, because for me, a book is engrossing. You have to be immersed in the world, but you have a normal life too. And I'm not one of those writers that makes everybody tiptoe around and be very quiet because, oh my God, she's making art. Oh, please, it's a job. You know, I'm not one of those people that has any sympathy with people who can only write when they're inspired. Put your butt in a chair and write. That's when you'll be inspired. It's you have to treat it like a job, or you will write maybe a book in your lifetime rather than have a career. But having said that, there is some of that artistic moodiness that you just can't seem to get away from when you do this. And I try not to rain all everybody's plate. I guess Jonathan would be the one to say whether I manage that or not. He gives me the thumbs up.
So. Awesome. All right, so now with basically what is right now, what is the next step in your life right now? Like, what is up in the horizon for you? Like, is it maybe Anita Blake being optioned for a movie, TV show, anything like that at all? Or
I can only tell you what my agent says on this question, which is at this time there's nothing signed.
Darn.
I actually have a sort of fun question to ask you, just up in the air. If you could pick any actors and any actresses to play, say if you
I
did.
I can't answer that question. I can't answer that question.
No?
Would you prefer to be you?
No, God. One, I'm not an actor. And, you know, I don't know if I could act well enough to do it. See, you know, that's one of the things. People go, well, when we sit down to see if we could do a script, people say, oh, you can do a script because you're a writer. I'm going, but a script is a different kind of writing. So until I put my butt in a chair and actually wrote some script and found out, actually, I am really pretty good at it. And Jonathan and I together are even faster and better at it. But until I tried it, I didn't know. Well, yes, I did. I have some drama background, and I acted in college and in high school, but that was college and high school. And having the star presence in front of a camera to carry a movie, even people who are really, one of the things is we do get look at the movie industry and see, try to figure out how it works, is that people who are actually very good actors, like on stage, the camera doesn't always love you. There really is something about, I don't know if it's bone structure or a certain spark, but not everybody that's a good actor works as well on camera as they do in person. Just like some people take good pictures no matter what they're doing, you know?
Yeah.
Other people don't. it's the same thing for a moving camera. I'm not so arrogant to think that I could pull that off. And also, if I was doing that, I couldn't write. There's no way. There's absolutely no way I could be that involved with a movie. It's a really vigorous schedule, and actually keep up with the writing. I that whole sleeping thing and having like a child and actually wanting to not have her not see me the whole time she's growing up kind of thing.
Yeah, those things can kind of
get in the way.
But, yeah, if you ever look at some of the biographies of famous writers, most of them are men, first of all. And not all, but most. And the women, if you look at them, you get much more in their diaries and stuff about having to take care of the kids and support the family than you do with the men, because the men had wives that seemed to make it all invisible to them. And that's not what I do. I mean, yes, I get a lot of help from, with the kiddo, but I actually do, I did breed, I did have her. I actually like to spend time with her. And you can actually put enough on your plate, successful, wonderful projects, that you begin to lose pieces of your life. I refuse to tour on Halloween every year because everyone wants me on Halloween. Oh, they want me to do this. They want me to do that. My child is still young enough. She wants us to go trick-or-treating with her. She thinks we're cool. Well, I hear from friends with older children that she won't think we're cool forever. And she won't want to go trick-or-treating forever. So every year, I refuse. One year, I went and did World Fantasy for Halloween when she was very small. And that was the year she dressed up as Dorothy, and her best friend was Glinda the Good Witch.
Aww. That is so cute.
Okay, the camera broke, and the video camera ate itself.
Oh, no.
I didn't get to see a single image or picture from that Halloween.
Wow.
You probably never forgave yourself for that, eh?
Well, I thought that was the universe's reminder to prioritize. And so, yeah, you have to be careful with success, because success can eat you up in many, just as much as failure can. You're still successful, you make money, and it's really good, and outwardly it looks good, but if you lose your life and lose what's important in your life, then I don't think it's a fair trade. So you have to be careful with success, but it doesn't get to be too much.
I'm thinking that's actually a very sound piece of advice I should probably take into my professional life. My coworkers are looking at me right now going, yeah, you should probably listen to her.
Yeah, yeah. just a little.
Success is really hard to be. And as I get more successful and get recognized, like, at movie theaters and out shopping with my kid, which I, as a writer, didn't expect. You don't expect to be recognized like that. That's what actors and singers and, more entertainers do. What I've learned is that this is an entertainment industry, like it or not. You have to, one, don't believe your own hype, because you're never as good as they say or as bad as they say. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, remember what made you successful. Some writers get a little bit of success, not quite as much as I do. They let it go to their heads, and suddenly they go on the convention circuit and they go and talk about writing, but they begin to write less and less. So I took that as a lesson early on, and so that no matter how successful I get, I have to remember that what makes me successful is the book. So you have to keep actually leaving yourself enough time to write the books.
Extremely nice. And wow. Well, Laurel, we are just about out of time here. I was wondering if you could possibly offer the listeners of This Week in Geek something a little bit exclusive in the Anita Blake universe, or maybe something from Mary, perhaps.
Please.
Even if it's cryptic.
Okay.
Can I expect cryptic to see more of Anita Blake or even Mary in other novels?
Well, I am in the midst of working on book 16. Of Anita. There's no title, can't even give you that. It's a working title at this point. It is, we get to actually see Jason, who's been a minor major character since book 4. We actually get to go home and meet his family.
Oh, wow.
Ooh.
We actually get to see somebody's family background. And of course, though, Anita's with him, and it goes horribly, horribly wrong. And we are oh, I can't say that. I'm going, let's just say that we have just about the time that we think we're getting the Audure under control, it goes more wrong than it's ever gone wrong before.
Wow.
Dun, dun.
Well, thank awesome. You, yeah. Laurel, for that. We definitely appreciate that. Yeah.
I think the listeners will definitely appreciate that, too. Thank you so much.
Now, one last thing to do for fun for the people that we interview is that basically we ask two specific questions. It's kind of more of going along, obviously, the James Lipton. Got to go back to that again. Basically,
you and your studio.
Yeah, I love this thing, man. Okay, one question is, what is your favorite curse word?
I can't say my favorite curse word. You told me not to.
You can say it. It's okay. We'll bleep it out.
The one I say the most often?
Yeah.
It's...
Awesome.
You just made our day. We just heard Laurel K. Hamilton say
awesome. Now, the last question is, now, if heaven exists and you go to the pearly gates, what would you like God to say to you for the first time?
Rest for a while, and then you get to go back.
Ooh,
I like that.
Interesting. All right. Well, perfect.
You're the Highlander.
Well, no. More religions on this planet believe reincarnation than don't.
Definitely. I agree with you on that one.
Well, everyone, you just heard the interview with Laurel K. Hamilton. It was an awesome interview. Definitely one of the most fun things I've had to do in quite some time. We learned a lot about her writing process, the character of Anita Blake, and some other interesting factoids.
Laurel rules.
So we definitely appreciate having her on the show. Laurel, is there anything you'd like to say to the listeners of This Week in Geek?
Just that everybody do what makes you most happy. And, as long as you don't hurt anybody else.
And buy her books.
And don't bug her on Halloween.
I'm not allowed to say that, but thank you for saying it.
No problem.
Want to see me make bubbles with my spit?
Sure do. In fact, that's the theme of our next show. So don't miss it.
Why is the program, like, freaking out?
It's doing it again! This program... Communism! Freaking communism!
Can you count pi to 1,000 places? Wait, if you can, you're too much of a nerd.
They gave us a show and we still don't know what we're doing.
I don't know either.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Tune in next week where you hear Mike say,
I'm ad-libbing this as I go along. I'm just going to let it roll and I can edit out whatever I want. Okay. I need to think.
So make sure to tune in next Wednesday at 4:30 p.m. on 90.1 FM The New Heat. Also, make sure to visit our website at thisweekingeek.net for show notes, news, and updates about the show. Also, make sure to add yourself to our MySpace page at myspace.com/thisweekingeek. If you'd like to send comments or feedback about the show, email us at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. That's it for us. We'll see you next week on This Week in Geek.
And now, an ad from Dad.
All right. Save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive.
Can I take these off?
All right.
What is this? This looks good.
Wow.
That's well made.
Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Your home is important. That's why GEICO helps make it easy to save on condo insurance. Because home is more than just a place. Home is where you took minimalism too far because there's only one chair in your entire condo and your only entertainment is one card. Not even a deck of cards, but a single card. And all your guests have to share one plate and one fork, but you're convinced that less stuff means more freedom. The GEICO Insurance Agency could help protect the overly minimalist broom closet you call home. Call GEICO and see how easy it is to switch and save on condo insurance.